The first thing an artist finds out when he is very, very young, and what occurs at that point in this hypothetical artist's life, is a kind of silence. The first thing he finds out is that for reasons he cannot explain to himself or others, he does not belong anywhere. And you begin to discover that you're moving and you cannot stop this movement to what looks like the edge of the world.
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum that colorblind ideology built?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility?
Hey everyone, welcome, and thanks for joining us on The Tightrope, where we engage in deep dialogue and try our very best to stay and keep our balance on tough issues. I'm Tricia Rose, and I'm here with the greatest intellectual on the planet, Dr. Cornel West, and he's also a dear friend. Hello, Corn. How are you? How's it going?
Oh, how you doing, my dear sister? You're so kind. I would say you are the wisest and the most insightful intellectual of your generation. That's the truth right there.
It's no more true than what I already said about you. So now I topped you back. So there you have it. No, I'm serious. I'm serious as a heart attack. So this summer, and I know people can watch this at any time, but we're in such a moment when so much is swirling around us and so much is sort of taking our energy in the world and also creating a fundamental sense of insecurity and worry. And I guess I'm just wondering if there's anything you've been thinking about this sort of summer of pandemics. I say plural because certainly racially, I think we've had a pandemic too. And I'm wondering if is there something that you have been reflecting on that you think might be interesting for our listeners to reflect on around the summer of pandemics 2020?
Yeah, well, I think in my own little mind, it's a matter of really wrestling with what it means to be on intimate terms with catastrophe, which is, of course, a blues form of being in the world. That I think of the Russian blues man, Fyodor Dostoevsky, Notes from the Underground. He starts with, I'm a sick man, I'm a spiteful man, I'm a most unpleasant man. I think my liver is diseased. And you think about America, it's a sick society. Martin Luther King Jr. reminded us that before the bullet hit him. It's a spiteful society, and at the moment it's most unpleasant for a variety of different reasons, economically, socially, politically, psychically, spiritually. And yet Dostoevsky always had a love response, that he was so deeply rooted in the attempt to accent the potentiality of human beings, even given our evil proclivities. But he was mature, which meant that he also began with humility, and he connected humility, tenacity, always the benchmark of spiritual maturity. And so I think we find ourselves in an empire, in a fading, fragile democratic experiment, where we have to come to terms with catastrophe such that we are not surprised by evil nor paralyzed by despair. That's what it is to be a blues person. So you're not overwhelmed by the white supremacy. You're not hit by the side when the male supremacy or the homophobia, transphobia, or when the predatory capitalism is running out of control. You just get ready. You get fortified. You get well equipped, as it were. Now, I mean, Dostoevsky's Man on the Underground, we can connect to Richard Wright's A Man Who Lived Underground, 1942, or Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man Who Goes Underground. But by going underground, you actually are engaging in an excavation. You're trying to get beneath all the superficiality.
Right.
You're trying to try to see what is buried and then bring it to the fore, like that first line of W. Du Bois's Soul of Black Folk. It's lie buried here are certain things, this strange feeling, strange sense of what it means to be Black in America. Excavation, get down into that funk beneath the deodorized discourses of the day.
Yeah, wow. Let me ask you to say a little bit more about this sickness, this parasitic and fundamental sickness you described. I mean, do you think there is fundamentally more evil and human sickness in the world than there is goodness, generosity, altruism, hope, and sort of love and so on? I mean, do you think they're battling for supremacy, or do you think pretty much we're kind of underdogs on the love side.
On the love side. No, I think that love is always weak and feeble. It appears to be impotent. It appears to be powerless. And yet somehow it bounces back. So at this deeper level of a philosophical conception of who we are as a species, I do think our dominant orientations are those of envy and resentment and power and domination. And it's the counter response that have to be so deeply cultivated. You have to learn how to love. Egoism and narcissism is much more instinctual.
For everybody, you think, or do you think the U.S. and sort of the legacy of empires in the world are more culpable for developing and sustaining that kind of problem? Or do you think there are any distinctions between different traditions, different cultures, different religious practices that might offset that disequilibrium, as it were?
I think when cultures are able to hold on to high levels of spiritual excellence and moral greatness, they're able to pass it on to the younger generations, and therefore they have cultures that are more gentle and sweet and kind. Now, how long that lasts is an open question. So history does matter, culture does matter, but there's some basic kinds of instinctual proclivities that we have as species, which are not the best things when unregulated. Greed, envy, resentment, indifference to the suffering of others. And every culture, every color, every sexual orientation, every gender has that we know.
Yeah. And actually, you know, I already had a whole different answer to my own question, which goes back to actually confirms your original point, because even societies and practices and traditions that have lots of levels of sweetness and care and concern have been, for the most part, brutally patriarchal. Women have historically, across the globe, no matter how much that sweetness and kindness and family orientation may have been celebrated, it's been almost without exception at the expense of women everywhere. So now actually that just basically goes back to Dostoevsky. So all roads apparently lead right on back to my diseased liver, right? I guess.
That diseased liver, but he's holding up the bloodstained banner of love and justice. And as long as that love and justice is unsuffocatable, then we've got hope.
Yes.
But if you're looking for early victory, then don't get on the love train if you're looking for early victory.
No. We got malls for that. Shopping. We got shopping for that.
<That's so true>.
You want a quick victory? Go get you an ice cream. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's true. I also just wanted to highlight one other thing you said I think is so important for us to really think about, which is creating some space, right? Whether it's burrowing down, you know, whether it's dodging, right? Whether it's just turning away, whether it's exuberant dance, whether it's just laughing until you cry, but the effort to know that you're in difficult circumstances, you're not surprised by it, you're not shocked by it, you haven't given in either, right? You haven't relinquished yourself to that situation, but you're also working on some strategies, right? For how much depth is this sort of onslaught going to have on me? How much penetration into my spirit, my body, my mind, my consciousness is going to have? So there are choices that are extremely important there that cultivate and create room for that kind of joy and human connection, but at the same time, help you keep some distance. When people ask me, what are you doing to survive? And I said, mainly I'm just trying to keep the right level of distance. Mm-hmm. You can't be too far away, too removed, untouched, sort of wandering around with your head in the clouds with so much human suffering. But if you live right on the edge of it, of the wildfire, eventually you will go up in smoke. So figuring out that distance. When you said that, that was very moving to me.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And you want the right kind of friends, the right kind of partners, the right kind of companion. You hope you have the right kind of family. Mm-hmm. Because those kind of relations constitute the very oxygen of the soul.
That's right.
Nobody can do it by themselves. No matter how strong we think we are, you can't do it by yourself.
No, we often learn that one the hard way. So definitely. So even on the tightrope, you need friends. Although too many people on the tightrope and none of us are going to make it. So we had to We got to reduce our numbers up there. But thank you for sharing that. That was very thought-provoking. And I know that even though this summer is particularly brutal, there'll be other summers. So this will be what we call evergreen reflection. This is not the last struggle that we're going to have. But today we have a blessing with us for sure. We have a fantastic young artist, Yara Shahidi, and we want to welcome her to the tightrope. Yara is an actress, a model, an activist. She first gained widespread popularity for her role as Zoe, the oldest daughter of the Johnson family on the very popular sitcom Black-ish. At that point, she was 14 years old. Unbelievable. She now stars in and is the producer of the spinoff show from Black-ish called Grown-ish, and it's about Zoe's college experiences. She's the youngest producer to work on network television. In addition to her roles on screen, Yara and her mother have just announced the launch of a production company, which I'm eager to hear about, called Seventh Son. And she's working with ABC to develop and produce scripted and alternative television projects for cable. At 20 years old, I just don't even know what to say about that. Yara is also a Harvard College student and a student of our dear Dr. West. Graceful, talented, elegant, and an inspiring, sharp-minded, outspoken voice in her generation and in Hollywood is Yara Shahidi. Welcome to the tightrope.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. I was on mute, but taking notes in my journal about your Dr. West's comments on coming into close contact with catastrophe.
Well, I take notes when he talks all the time. I try to keep it below the Zoom camera because it's a little distracting, but I'm so glad you've been thinking about that yourself, huh?
Most definitely. I mean, there's some maintenance of hope that's necessary and found myself in pretty consistently is that of a perpetual existential crisis, that exciting burden of almost knowing too much and knowing that you don't know enough. And especially in this time, as a part of a generation that has inherited a world that has been consistently improved by generations previously, but it's very obvious how much work there is left to be done and that this is an ongoing process. It's the grand question of why do we continue to do this?
Well, I tell you, Sister Tricia, Professor Rose, Sister Yara is one of the most brilliant, elegant, and eloquent students to grace, to come through my classroom, to grace my classroom, really. And I won't go into her magnificent papers that she's written and things, but I tell you,
I can tell based on what she just said that those are some bad papers, yeah. Definitely.
So my first question to my dear sister is, and I want you to give a hug to Sister Carrie, your beloved mother. Her mother's come to classes too, and she's marvelous and magnificent. Oh, yes, she is. But say something about your calling. When was it that you realized what your fundamental mission was here as artist, as intellectual, as force for good?
Yeah, well, I come from an extremely humanitarian family. And so I think, like, especially on my mother's side, my grandfather was extremely involved in the civil rights movement. And so there was, an assumption that no matter where you went in the world, there had to be some sort of greater impact with your platform. And so many of my family members are educators or in STEM or whatever their field may be. I think this is a continuing thread when I look at really much of my family tree. But even at the age of 7, when I had to name my corporation, as I guess every 7-year-old does.
Every 7-year-old.
Yes. But the name of my corporation is Dharma Driven. And it has been for the past, I don't know, how old am I now? 13 years. And so purpose has always been extremely important for me. And then getting into acting as an outlet for that, I think that came more so as a surprise. I have always wanted to be a historian. I had a 10th birthday party where I told all my friends to dress up as what they wanted to be in the world. And I was in a seersucker suit with a pocket watch because that was my goal. But acting has always been a surprising avenue for me. I think I just always loved the importance of storytelling. Because my parents very intentionally created an alternate curricula in which I think much of what I was intaking, I felt centered, or it was intentionally introducing me to other cultures. And so coming from that background, acting as an opportunity to continue to tell those stories was extremely exciting. And my parents have always come from the perspective of acting something that we do and not who we are, which is sometimes antithetical to the idea of being called an actor, but it really was freeing because it became one of many outlets, and it didn't halt the process of being interested in the world, in whether it be through trying to expand my philanthropic work, whether it be through my academic studies, or even producerially. It's been an exciting jump to be in the process of actually creating television and creating films, because I think ultimately this was the space that I've wanted to be in for such a long time, in which my storytelling isn't limited to the characters that I can or cannot play.
Yes, indeed.
Wow.
Indeed.
So Yara, I'm wondering, following from this very clear sense of calling and intention, right? I mean, that's very powerful, and I'm sure it's been very steadying in such a tumultuous time. But I started doing some basic math, because that's mostly as far as I can go. I started thinking, okay, if you're 20 now, that means in 2012, when Trayvon Martin was killed, you were 12 years old. And then the next year, Black Lives Matter was founded, you were 13 years old. And then 3 years ago, when you were 17, was when Me Too went viral. And I basically decided your whole adolescence was grappling with whirling set of crises and documented, visually, narratively portrayed exposures of a tremendous amount of corruption, of collusion, of violence, of disregard. How did you grapple with that, being at the intersection of your own concerns about race and injustice, and you're being at the center of Hollywood at the same time? Can you share a little bit about how your calling and all of the ways that you developed it, you know, either holding you in good stead or challenging for you at that time?
Right. No, I mean, it's something that I think about consistently. One thing that I've been thinking about, I turn and have conversations with so many of my peers, was in what ways, given the time that we were growing up, was the myth of utopia not even granted to us? We were born into a world in which we've seen corruption at heightened levels. And I think with the advent of social media, it's only become clearer, because we have access to what is happening globally in a way in which I don't know if I was like at 12, how my life would have changed if there wasn't a social media kind of monolith in which I was connecting with people globally and understanding what was happening globally. And so in many ways, purpose has been two-pronged in that it has helped me with an exceeding amount of clarity move forward and say, okay, what are the moves that I want to make in my world to try and make an impact? And I think shows like Black-ish, I'm really grateful for, because we are grappling with a lot of these topics. And I don't know under any other circumstances, if it weren't for the fact that I was on a show that was talking about these things, where they would have turned and handed a mic to a 13, 14 year old to say, what do you feel about this? And so I've also had the privilege, I think, both creatively and then also just in my home, to constantly be refining my opinion on the world. My family and I are in constant conversation about absolutely everything. And it's almost a training ground, for lack of a better term, because it's able to process, feel, and articulate my initial opinion, completely change it, learn a little more, and evolve, which was helpful. And at the same time, it's hard with as much as what's happening in the world right now to figure out how I'm most efficient. I say that to say I'm somebody where I feel like if I'm not directly doing the most good possible, then I'm doing nothing. And I'm trying to stop operating in those extremes, because I think it's easy to trivialize everything. Like, for example, I feel as though people who plan red carpets also know when the world is about to burn, because every major red carpet event happens when the world is properly in catastrophe. And there's nothing more trivial than standing there after getting 2 hours of hair and makeup and a really nice dress that somebody was nice enough to let me wear while there's so much happening in the world. It feels really myopic to be there. And so I think it means that the question is ever present to say, how efficient am I being with my platform to actually be combating the things that I say I want to combat? And I think that the beauty of constantly learning more, whether it just be my literal academic journey or my journey outside of the classroom, has also meant that it's led to an extreme interrogation of self. You know, I love the fact that I get to produce content. And what does it mean to be entrenched in corporate America in a way that I'm still figuring out, in a way that I'm still grappling with? And how do I balance the impact of what I'm doing on a personal level to the positive impact I make to this corporate world that I'm still figuring out how I want to deal with it?
We're all still trying to figure that out, Yara. You're early in that game.
Yes.
We all.
No, I know.
the fact that you come, my dear sister, from two world historical people. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you know, the oldest surviving document we have when it comes to plays is 472 BC, the Persians by Aeschylus. Mm-hmm. And from there, the largest empire in the world at that time, Cyrus the Great, the only grand emperor who didn't revel in such vicious conquests, but believed in coexisting of those he actually incorporated. Then on to it, then the Iranians and so forth. Mm-hmm. Then you got black folk in the belly of the U.S. beast, every possible form of abomination, domination, degradation. And yet here come these love warriors, every mm-hmm. generation on the stage, blowing their horns. Some of them professors at Brown, others on mm-hmm. the block. I mean, what a tradition. How do you negotiate and navigate the best of these two world historical peoples coming through your precious parents on the sister Yana herself?
You've met my parents, and I'm really grateful to have the upbringing that I've had, just because they've reveled in the fact that I'm an absolute nerd. And so I think everything from what I was watching to the experiences that I had, I was like the educational guinea pig in my family. So I've done homeschooling, and then I've gone to Montessori and then an all-girls Catholic school, but it was all really driven by a desire to ensure that I had a holistic learning experience. And so regardless of what my education looked like, a lot was supplemented at home. But I think the question of being, I've always been proudly Black and proudly Iranian, but it's taken on new meaning walking into my young adulthood. At first, it's just like this heritage that I was grateful to have, but in a world in which I'm somebody where, like, one of my personal mentors is Patrice Cullors, co-founder of Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And so I think I've been more well-versed being growing up in Minnesota and then California in what it means to traverse the world as a young Black girl. And the question now is, what does it mean to really have both? I understand what it means to be culturally Iranian, but in a time in which being Iranian does take on political meaning that I'm not as familiar with, in a way that I have to, I think, interrogate further. Even the past couple of weeks was a prime example of this, is that I remember right as everything's happening in the States, there's also protests happening in Iran, and trying to even figure out what my role in that is, knowing that my words when speaking on behalf of the Iranian people have repercussions on my family that don't exist to the same extent here. Right. And those are just a couple of things. The only reason I bring that up is that it's been interesting to have always reveled in these two cultures and felt really grateful for what they have had to offer and how they've enhanced my life and how I view the world. And at the same time, realizing that as I get older, they take on new meaning, and then have to interrogate, what does it mean to be Black or Iranian in a very particular space? And so I'm constantly figuring that out. And I kind of on a path to figure out how I relate to the world. And do I detach it from how the world relates to me? Because until you hear my full name, I don't know if people are looking at me like, oh, look, there's a young Iranian girl, to the same extent that they see a young Black girl.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Very much so.
I'm sure they, for the most part, see you as a young, beautiful Black girl. Yeah, probably. Maybe not in LA, where there's a big Persian community. But you mentioned this risk that you're describing of sort of, what does it mean to speak out? What are the repercussions in different spaces, in different countries, in different communities? I mean, reading a little bit up on you for this conversation, there's a quote from an article that said that for you, the greatest skill about having a platform is handing over the mic. Mm-hmm. Can you describe that and what you mean by that? I think this is really interesting. And I'm just curious why you think that the greatest skill in having a platform is actually handing over the mic. How does that work for you?
Well, part of it is I know that I wouldn't be where I am if people hadn't handed the mic to me. Mm-hmm. I think of just how many people constantly inspire me. You said the name of my production company, which quite honestly, in full transparency, is I knew the name of my production company when I walked out of Professor West's class on Du Bois. And that became really the anchoring fact of how we decided on the name and what we represented.
Seventh Son,
but spelled S-U-N. Mm-hmm. The goal is to pierce the veil. But I think of all the times in which the mic has been handed to me. And I also know that being in kind of the larger media complex as an actor, there's an added component of when I do interviews, and I'm grateful for the compliment, but a lot of the terminology is like, oh, well, you're the voice of a generation, the face of a generation. And I always feel like that's doing my generation a disservice, especially knowing that I know a lot about certain topics, but I do not know a lot about everything. And so part of being in a world in which, as a socially engaged human, I'm trying to figure out how to respond to these ongoing crises is figuring out what I don't know and when to turn to people who have been grappling with a certain topic more fully. And even in production, I think that space has become even clearer since a lot of the work that we're doing is bringing in younger writers, bringing in people whose stories haven't been centered and being able to actively collaborate with them, being able to help push them to whatever their next station is in their career. But that's something that I think I really inherited from my mother. If you meet her, she is so, I think, tuned in, for lack of a better phrase. And she's always exemplified what it means to hand the mic over because she pays such astute attention to people. And so to see the way in which she can connect to somebody that we either pre-pandemic ran into an airport or had a random conversation with and have the same level of impact with the people that she's had lifelong relationships with is extremely inspiring. And so I feel like it's really trying to take that mentality of how do I pay enough attention to the world around me to service it to the best of my ability that I try and take into these other spaces.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really powerful.
But it's so rare, though, that seems to me, when we get a celebrity who is so rooted in a genuine humility and undeniable precocity, but at the same time, a spiritual maturity. And so it looks like to me, you're transforming what it means to be a celebrity, especially for a generation that oftentimes is so hungry and thirsty for visibility and publicity, to be a spectacle and to have an image that everybody smiles at. And you keep it all the way down on the ground, keep it funky and human, and yet still be able to allow your gifts to flow from your soul to the world. I mean, that is just a magnificent example, though.
It's really remarkable. I know very little about Hollywood, but the little bit I've seen, it is not for the faint of heart. You know, I mean, it's voracious and I can't even begin to describe it. It's actually terrifying. It seems like it'd be a place where you would just basically lose your mind if you didn't work exceptionally hard at trying to keep it. And so, I mean, you know, it's true. So for you to be so poised, and there's a lot of ways you could go. You could be a self-righteous, I know a lot, I'm a nerd, and I'm going to make sure you know everything that I've learned to prove to you that I'm a nerd. You don't do that, right? You're just reading and learning, and you're constantly focusing on what you didn't read yet, which is the sign of a true nerd, by the way. that's all you worried about, all the books you didn't read. But just to do it with such grace, and also to still be interested in questions of joy and beauty and using your modeling and your role as an actress, basically to avoid that binary between sort of pleasant, beautiful things on the one hand and sort of protest and sort of scowl on the other. You've figured out really how to combine these things in a joyful way that's also still very committed. I mean, I think that's very, very difficult. Did you have any sort of support network in Hollywood that, or do you have one? I'm just going to hope that, I know your mom is obviously significant, but there's also just Hollywood in general. Is there a support network that's been helpful to you?
Most definitely. I mean, of course, I think my family is a core group. We've made everything a family activity. And so whether it be my first day on set, my brothers always come visit and vice versa. Even my littlest 12-year-old brother will charge me $25 a week if I want to run lines with him. But as a whole, I'm pretty lucky for the time that I think I entered Hollywood, because I feel like there are a lot of people, especially in our brown and black community, who have been doing the important work of trying to get rid of concepts of competition and such. And so I entered at a time in which I feel like I very much entered with a lot of uncles and aunties. And so that was really great. Even turning to the Blackish environment, Kenya Barris, the creator of Blackish and then of Grownish, I think he saw a producer in me before I did. Yeah, he was the one who said, like, this is your next step, and had been playing with, like, well, how do we get you into the Writers Guild or the Directors Guild? How do we introduce you to these experiences? He called me first when we were building the Grownish Writers Room and said, well, what writers do you want to hire? So I got to make the first reach out to the people that inspired me. And so I think things like that were just extremely impactful. Mm-hmm. And I think even turning to the people that I haven't directly worked with, I think of even whether it be Angela Bassett and Courtney Vance, who are incredible artists in their own right, and the level of support they showed me in as people that are extremely academic and mm-hmm. creatives in helping me as I was going on this own journey of figuring out, okay, I have a full-time job and I have a deep desire to learn. And how do I right. fulfill both? And so to be able to mm-hmm. turn to the people around me and for them to be able to have those really open, honest conversations is something that I really am grateful for. And it's helped us stay sane because we have each other. And you're absolutely right. Hollywood is an interesting machine. And I think the only thing that keeps me grounded is that I'm pretty sure it doesn't exist. And so it's fun because I'm like, I'll just go play in this imaginary world.
Interesting machine. That really is.
Right. I tell you, it can eat you alive, but it just it's not even there, right? Yeah. Wow.
Now, I know on the one hand, you're a wonderful father. He had a relation to Prince. Mm-hmm. It was one of the artists and photographers and so forth. So he had already been exposed to someone who was such a major celebrity and genius and what have you. Then on the other mm-hmm. hand, though, you've got this wonderful relationship with our dear sister Michelle Obama, who strikes me mm-hmm. as somebody who is very down to earth, somebody mm-hmm. who is very humble in her relations to those around her. She and Brother Barack have done a magnificent job with the two daughters. Of course, Malia is a mm-hmm. student there at Harvard. But does that Prince connection on the one hand and the Michelle Obama connection on the other make a yeah. difference in your life?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you mentioned Prince because I really do feel like he created the foundation for how we move through this industry. Mm. When my father, he was his photographer for over 10 years, and we went on tour with him. Mm. We were able to have these experiences together because Prince prioritized family. And so even when you speak to the families that really surrounded him in this time, many of the families know each other and know each other's kids because that was something that was really accepted and encouraged. And so I think in a world in which entertainment is highly individualistic, for that to be our first touch point and for him to really invest in my father too and invest in his creative vision is what allowed us to continue to flourish because we came to LA really for his career. He'd been not knowing that acting was around the corner, that we wanted to be proximate to Hollywood by any means, but just because we had this opportunity. And even thinking about when my first movie came out, he rented copies for everyone to have. And even when I had the blessing of visiting Paisley Park some years ago, my headshot was still in there with the sign to Mr. Prince, Hart Yara.
Wow, see, that's so beautiful.
I'm constantly reflecting because at four, when a lot of this was happening, I didn't really understand, of course, the magnitude of what was happening. But I think I constantly reflect on the continued impact, his literal impact on our family, but then just overall as an artist and as a creative. And then, like you're saying, I call it the General Obama effect because I remember, again, when you talk about people that are tuned in, you will meet them on a day in which they're talking to 300 plus other people and it feels like you're the only person in the room. And
that's a special gift. That's a very special gift.
Yes.
It really is.
But going to support, I remember I was working with the administration really in their last year. And to, again, once people have handed over the mic to me, to know that I was able to co-host the White House Science Fair and was able to celebrate International Day of the Girl, as well as Nowruz, which is Persian mm-hmm. New Year at the White House, is really special. But that again goes into a deep investment when I think there are plenty of other people to turn to who are incredible humans in this space. The fact that anybody had turned to me was really incredible to think about. But yeah, I think those impacts, just as people who model how to move through the world, is really impactful to see that as an example, because I feel like it creates a space to make even my journey even easier.
Wow.
That's beautiful. You know, I'm 67 years old. When you were 67 and look back, what would you like people to say about your working witness?
I don't know. I'm unsure. I mean, my last name, Shahidi, means witness or to bear witness. And I mean, I hope that through art or whatever these other avenues are, I'm considering law school, we'll see, whatever these avenues are, that I'm able to do that to the best of my ability and to continue to open doors in every space. I mean, even I think Professor West, thinking about my journey at school, you know, entertainment and education is not something that they make easy. But I remember stepping in your class and you ensured me that I belonged there. And that was really why I turned back to a whole studio system where I have a show and turned to this institution of Harvard to say, how are we going to make this work? And as you know, it was those 70-hour weeks and school, but it was your presence that I think really assured me that I had a space there, and it was prescient that I was there at this time, like that I was placed in this space at the time that I was placed there. I think when I think of all of those moments that have so deeply impacted me every step of my way, and I'm sure there's only more to come, hoping that I can provide those for the people around me is really the end goal. And I'm constantly refining it. I think some days I just want to professionally ride jet skis, and other days I'm like, I want to change the world. Other days I'm like, I want to run a music studio.
Yeah, right. Yes. That's right. Well, you talk a lot about joy in things that I've read about you and how important it is to be joyful, not as a way of avoiding suffering, but as a way to survive the kind of death impulse that we see. So when you say one day you want to save the world, the next day jet skis, the next day music, you know, in the studio, that sounds like a God darn plan to me, you know, because what are you going to do? Try to save the world every day? You got to take a break. You got to do something else.
Right.
And it has to be part of what you're doing, not just a breather from, but a kind of joyful sort of spirit. Maybe I was just underdeveloped, but at 20, I don't think I had any clue about that. So I don't know what I would have answered Cornell's question with. I don't have any idea. I don't even actually want to know. But how did you come to this understanding of both the importance of joy and the importance of social justice at the same time? Is there some moment when these things really came together and you realized they needed to be together?
I feel like Baldwin, for me, James Baldwin, just in his work, emphasized the importance of both. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was, I think, 13 or 14 when I read Sonny's Blues. And it was one of those moments where I feel like he held both a really searing understanding of our oppression while still, I describe it as like watching or looking at a Kehinde Wiley painting, in that there's something about it where you're acknowledging our oppression. And at the same time, our brilliance is never something that you let go of or allow us to let go of. I'm consistently figuring it out. Even in this very notebook that I'm taking notes in, I feel like a lot of the questions that I had even moments ago was grappling with questions of, and I know I'm going to say it wrong, but nadir and Zion, and what do I desire, and what happens when I feel like we're at our lowest point? Because I am somebody that I think unabashedly feels affected by the world. And I'm somebody that takes things very personally. And I think when you're part of any very strong community, it's our tendency to, because it does feel very personal. And so trying to figure out, I feel like it was more so a coping mechanism of realizing, as somebody that does take things very personally, what do I have to institute in my life to make this a sustainable practice? Because, and I'm also being reminded by people consistently of the importance of pace and of the importance of finding joy. And so whether it be simple things of, I think I survive off of music. And so really prioritizing that in my life have been simple things that have made such a big difference to me. But I'm consistently trying to find the balance, because I think there's also an association of guilt with joy too, especially now. To be like, well, do I deserve to be happy, or do any of us deserve to be happy when so much is happening in the world? I think I'm trying to frame it as really a reclamation of the space. I feel like one of the great ills of white supremacy is the fact that it's taken away our Black imaginary and ability to dream in what is yet to come, having to be so focused on the practical and what's happening now.
Right. Well, it hasn't taken yours away.
That's the truth.
Trying not to.
It's trying. It's trying to do it. So before,
you're part of the Afrofuturism that flows best of the past, mediated through the present, because the artists are the vanguard of the species, and the poets and musicians are the vanguard of the vanguard, and you're a fundamental part of that vanguard. It's a beautiful thing. It's a heavy burden, and it's a joyful burden all at the same time. You keep your smile and keep your style.
Thank you.
And keep a copy of your favorite Baldwin book nearby, because you know, he keeps, I see you do. So you got to show everybody your stack. You got a stack right here. Raise them up.
Right. This wasn't even all of them. But this was just my little stack.
That's your local stack.
Yes, that was my local stack. This is one of my favorite gifts, which is a signed copy of Go Tell It on the Mountain.
Wow. And
my graduation gift from high school was to listen to Raoul Peck speak about the development of I'm Not Your Negro. So we went to the Schonberg Center and heard him speak.
Wow. Fantastic.
But you got Baldwin's actual signature.
It's so surreal. I don't open the book. I struggle with, like, do I open this book? Do I deserve to even look at these words?
You should show it to us.
Show us the signature. Yeah, that looks like a first edition.
Well, you know how rare it is to get a chance to see that genius. I know he was left-handed. Yes. So let's see what it is. Wow.
So wow, that's a beautiful signature.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Brother Jimmy. That's Brother Jimmy. Isn't that beautiful?
Surreal. Mm.
He's just really so important right now.
Never forget him. Good God Almighty. That's beautiful.
This is your short stack, which means these are your immediate tools of the psychic trade. So what's one of the things you love the most, or one of the passages, or one of the essays, or one of the ideas? Just if you have something that isn't going to, you know, be too hard to call up. She got a page. Why don't you tell us what page it is so we can pull out our own copies? We're going to have our own little office hours right here.
This is in one of his uncollected writings. It's called The Artist's Struggle for Integrity. And I just recently read it the other day as I was going back through my short stack in honor of his birthday some days ago. But he has this passage on the artist. And there were, if you don't mind me reading for a second, there
no,
was something
please.
I really had loved here, which he says, the first thing an artist finds out when he is very, very young, and what occurs at that point is in this hypothetical artist's life, is a kind of silence. The first thing he finds out is that for reasons he cannot explain to himself or others, he does not belong anywhere. And you begin to discover that you're moving and you cannot stop this movement to what looks like the edge of the world. But then even hopping down, he had said, the crime of which you discover slowly you are guilty is not so much that you are aware, which is bad enough, but that other people see that you are and cannot bear to watch it because it testifies to the fact that they are not. And there was something about that that was really interesting, especially in a time in which I see so many of my peers. I think many people that are front lines in this movement are also creatives in the truest sense. Mm. And it's something that I struggle with, to see the level of vitriol sent their way in a movement that is so steeped in love. And so I think in hearing his words of that cognitive dissonance that occurs when you see somebody aware enough that it calls attention to your own state of sleep, that is what it stems from, really, I think, contextualizes this moment. So that was something I read just some days ago, and I just keep revisiting it.
Wow.
I really like that. And I like it because one of the things that happens is that we think of artists only as people who are either performers or functioning as sort of official artists in a given craft that we associate with the arts. But he's using artists there as a way of engaging and witnessing the world and thinking about what's going on. It's about a way of thinking and a way of being. So one could be a legal mind and be an artist. One can be a historian, as you were planning to be, and be an artist. One could be a philosopher like Doc is and be an artist as he is. So that's important because the other alternative is often your sort of a professionalization track, which is to just master whatever the rules are in a given trade, a given profession. But when you choose the artist track, the artist's way of seeing and being, now, you know, you become really a threat to the status quo. And there's so much possibility in that. So the creatives is this broad. I really like that. I've not read that, so I'm going to have to go back and check that. That's a beautiful thing to choose.
No, perfectly said. And it's why I immediately was just so drawn to it. It's an essay that's only 4 pages, but there's so much in there.
He can say so much in so little.
Oh, yeah.
4 pages in Baldwin is like 100 pages of most everybody else.
It's such a skill. I read The Protestant Ethic recently by Weber, and I was like, you know, this may be shallow, but I just kind of prefer Baldwin. There's something about the concise nature of it when I got to the point.
Yeah. He had a special gift.
So very true. I mean, that's why it's so hard to talk about Baldwin. We thank God for Brother Eddie's new book, Begin Again. I had published a wonderful book on Baldwin and the blues. But it's hard to get into Baldwin because you already have to undergo formation, deep cultivation, and maturation in order to get into his depths. You know what I mean?
Right.
If you're shallow and you jump in, you're just going to be dog pedaling on the surface. And he's essentially deep sea diving at the bottom. You think you got Baldwin. No, you got to get on down. You got to get on down. Get on down with it.
Indeed. That's true. And you know, you find, you read it, and I've read things over and over, and I'll look at my notes and think, but you're not even underlining the most important thing he's talking about. You know, 10 years later, that one didn't make any sense. I've stopped underlining because all it is a testament to my lack of reading capacity. So I just,
all of us have the same experience. So that's the truth.
I mean, yeah, he's so deep, those layers. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, Yara, it has just been such a pleasure to be here with you. And it's been so nourishing, and you're just got such a bright spirit. It's really a lovely thing. I'm very happy to really be able to be in conversation with you.
Thank you. As a listener of the podcast, I was excited to be invited on, but quite honestly, this is the conversation that I needed to hear right now. So I so appreciate you both.
No, we salute you, and anything we can do to allow you to continue to soar like an eagle, you just let us know.
Yes,
noted.
Indeed. Noted. Yeah, she will keep track, Cornell. She's not the type to forget. She won't forget.
No, indeed.
Is there anything you wanted to talk about it before we say so long, never goodbye? Just anything you wanted to get to that we didn't ask or that you want to share with people quickly?
I mean, there was so much that we covered that I'm trying to think of. I mean, other than just that conversation that we're having on joy being so important, I just want to say I'm so grateful for everyone being able to hold both conversations of really astutely analyzing the absolute chaos that we're in and somehow still finding the joy in it. I need it. And I think I thrive off of those conversations and everyone leading the way in that space.
Yeah, that's critical. I mean, look, the one thing that Cornell said, he's 67. The one thing that those extra decades between you and him, one of the things that's good about those decades is you begin to see that there is a pattern, right? These things happen. Mm-hmm. Many of them, good and bad, more than once. The first time they happen, it's like, this is it. Then you're like, the second time, this is kind of almost it. Then the third time, you're like, this might be it. And then by the sixth, seventh, eighth time, you're like, man, this is some foolery. It's happening all over again. Let me go get myself something to eat. You know, I can't be getting all. So you realize you have to be joyful because otherwise it will take your whole life, right? And that's one of the things you begin to see. But you already know this. You are definitely a grown person with an old spirit, with an ancient, well-developed spirit. So you've already figured this out. You really have. Yara, it was wonderful. The tightrope is a home for you anytime. So reach out, let us know. We'll reach out and check in. We'd love to have you back anytime.
No, I'd be happy to be back. But in the meantime, can't wait to continue to listen.
Great. Well, thanks for joining our little tightrope community.
Thank you. Indeed. Love and respect you. Love and respect you.
All right.
So much love.
Yes, indeed. All right. Thanks, Yara.
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to transition to our office hours. Right now, we're taping this. It's in August of 2020, and we're about to have some real office hours coming up in September, I'm sure. So, but for our newer listeners, our weekly segment called Office Hours is where we try to take a deep dive into an individual topic that may or may not be related to what the rest of the show or episode was about. But we're interested in intractable issues or recent concerns or losses. And many of us are continuing to reflect on the recent loss of our dear brother and social justice warrior, John Lewis. And today for Office Hours, we thought that we would reflect on and respond to his powerful last essay, but also his life and his legacy and what kinds of advice he gives us, what kinds of love weapons he's left for us to pick up and take with us. Now, you've known John Lewis a long time, Cornell, so why don't you share with us what moves you the most about what he did and what made him unique and what we can give to others to take away about his legacy?
I think my dear brother John Lewis was part of a rich tradition of Black people that put a primacy on morality and a centrality on spirituality. He was such a kind human being. He was so gentle. He was a sweet person. Mm-hmm. He had a soulfulness to him. Mm-hmm. That when I looked in him, I could see Eddie Mae Lewis, his precious mama. I could see Eddie Lewis, his father. I could see that Black Baptist church way off in Jim Crow, gut bucket, Troy, Alabama. Then on his way to Nashville, then he meets who? Jim Lawson. Now, Jim Lawson gave one of the most magnificent eulogies that we've ever had on television. Mm-hmm. Almost 92 years old. He'd be 92 in September. And he was the teacher. He was a professor. for John Lewis and with Diane Nash and all the great freedom fighters who came through. C.T. Vivian, older, but still with them in that regard. And, of course, Stokely Carmichael. Of course, you know, Brother Clinton had to hit Stokely. Clinton's wrong.
Completely unnecessary.
Stokely got more courage in him, in his left leg, than Clinton got in his whole body in terms of struggle for Black people. You don't have to agree with Stokely ideologically to know he's willing to pay it all, give it all in that
That's right.
Stokely is inseparable from John Lewis in that sense, even though they did go different ways. Clinton is right in that way. But I tell you one thing that we didn't get a chance to zero in on is the transition from John Lewis as one of the greatest Black freedom fighters of the 20th century to John Lewis as a neoliberal politician. When he makes that transition, you see, he's got the fire. He's got his history. We will love him and respect him and salute him forever. But those 33 years in Congress, when it looks at militarism, is he voting for military budgets? Is he critical of the drones that's being dropped by Bush or Obama? Is he standing up against Israeli occupation on behalf of occupied people, Palestinians? Those are the tests as well that we have to note. Now, given that it's just his death is fresh, it's going to take a while for a critical reflection to take place. The greatness, the heroic action, the courageous and visionary sacrifice. But then the 33 years as a politician, that also has to be taken seriously. Because by the time you get to his legacy, and they got the flag on the coffin, but he's an ordained Baptist minister. The cross is always over the flag. Every flag is under the cross for a Christian like John Lewis. You see what I mean? We didn't hear a whole lot about just that cross, that Jesus, that heroicism, that love, even critical of one's own establishment. So what happens? He ends up in that way, a kind of darling of the neoliberal establishment. And it's understandable because he's such a grand exemplar of moral conscience. But even he was under those pressures.
Yes.
Not able to follow through fully on the legacy of a Fannie Lou Hamer or Martin Luther King Jr. in Congress.
That's a very important insight, Cornell. But at the same time, I'm wondering, I mean, is it a fair standard to hold him to? I mean, can a person be in Congress 33 years, 15 years, 5 years, and not fundamentally have to wrestle with the contradictions that will, in a sense, require a less pure response, right? I mean, I just don't see how you do it. And there might be a couple of examples. So, I mean, it's not that I want to deny what he may or may not have been able to do, but I'm also wondering if it's even possible.
Well, I mean, is it the case that when you move from prophetic to the political, from prophet to politician, that you can't have the kind of prophetic reflection that cast a light on just how limiting and constraining the electoral political system is?
Right.
You see, that has to be part and parcel of a prophetic politician. If not, then it's an oxymoron.
Right, but is prophetic politician an oxymoron in and of itself?
That's the question, my dear sister. That's the question.
I think the answer is kind of
You would hope that you would be able to make Well, you know, our dialogue with AOC, that's part of the challenge.
Okay, right, that's true.
Part of the challenge. Paul Wellstone was one of the great ones in that regard. Adam Clayton Powell, up until the last, 5 or 6 years, he was always willing to show the limitations of the very system that he was a part of until he was seduced at the end.
Right.
Who would be Henry Gonzalez in Texas is one of the great examples.
And Bernie.
Brother Bernie is a great example. Now, Bernie's got a little advantage because not being a member of the Democratic Party, he has a bit more leeway
than the others
into the Democratic Party in that way. But I mean, even Bernie can be seduced, as we know, like all of us can be seduced.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I guess that's really the question, too. I mean, I think it's been very powerful to see how many more progressives are getting involved in electoral politics. I mean, even if we just tilt it a little bit, I'll take it. Right. And the question is also, when you're thinking about making sacrifices, it's usually, I mean, I don't know, I've not been in elected office, and let me tell you, I will never be, but I can imagine someone like John Lewis wrestling with making short-term compromises for what he thinks are stemming the tide of other long-term catastrophes that would replace what the options were that he ultimately felt he had.
Right,
so you're
right.
Really, you're looking at layers of catastrophe. Do I let a 10-level catastrophe happen, or do I basically co-sign a 5-level? I'm not trying to make excuses,
oh,
and
no,
you're right.
You know, what you say is so crucial, and it's powerful. I mean, one of the things we wrestled with at the very end of Brother John Lewis's life, and we should say he is one and only. I want people to know that, any criticism that I'm putting forward. But when he talked about Joe Biden as a man of conscience and courage.
Yeah. Yeah, that was unnecessary.
That sounds like he's more part of an echo chamber rather than an independent voice.
Yeah.
He's always been as a freedom fighter in the 60s and 70s. But I mean,
yeah.
You know, he's 80 years old. You know, if Martin King had lived to be 80, if Malcolm had lived to be 80, where would they have landed? It's just hard to say. But
It's hard to imagine that he would be saying that about Biden, you know.
Well, I don't think Martin would. We know Malcolm would.
And
that's why you need the Stokely's, you need H. Raff Brown.
Exactly.
Spirit, their fire, whether you agree with them ideologically or not, they're pushing. We must have that.
Just to go back to your reference to Bill Clinton's comment about Stokely, it's particularly mean-spirited, it seems to me, in a moment when there's so much violence and state-sponsored rage across various institutions being leveled at poor people and certainly Black people simultaneously. And then for you to focus on their potentially violently accepting, not necessarily being a proponent of the only choice, but they're accepting violence as one option in response to that brutal treatment. And then you want to talk about their violence being not the path. Where are you talking about your violence not being the path? I don't see any discussion about that. Don't come talking to me about what my violence might look like when you're constantly crushing my neck to death. That's the part that really just pissed me off for sure.
No, it's true. Stokely gave a speech October 20, 1966 at UC Berkeley. He started off, "I'm here at the intellectual ghetto of the West." He invoked George Bernard Shaw. He said, "All autobiography is critique. We got to dig ourselves. There's something that needs to be examined inside of ourselves." He then moves to Camus and Sartre and says, "Can we condemn ourselves?" And he says, "Why is it that the white folk who came down south, and includes the Quakers, came to us talking about nonviolence, but they didn't go to Jim Clark. They didn't go to Bull O'Connor. They didn't go to the Ku Klux Klan. They didn't go to the White Citizens Council.
No, yeah,
talk to them about nonviolence. We got a nonviolent folk, Jim Lawson. We got Martin Luther King Jr. We got a whole
bunch
of folk. You see what I mean?
Yeah, that's, who do you have, right? Exactly.
That's the level of hypocrisy, Stokely's point. Now, we must have Stokely.
Right, exactly. Hypocrisy. There's something about this requirement that we always respond from a nonviolent love ethic that does rub people the wrong way. It's one thing to choose. It's one thing to choose that as the strategy that you feel is going to best build the community you want to have in the future. It's another thing to be told by those who are in a comfortable position in that society, whatever that position may be, whether it's Black, middle class, wealthy, elite, corporate, that we need you to just settle down, put your guns down. Let's have a civil conversation. Well, where you been? This is not the beginning of this conversation.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, that's like, look, you're afraid that the world is not going to be comfortable for you. So you want to come back to me to see if I can make the world comfortable for you while I try to get 15 more cents out of this situation.
There you go. That's it. That's it.
Yeah, that's not going to work. So yeah, and Bill.
But
Bill,
thank God for Lawson. Thank God for Lawson.
Exactly. Yeah, that was a beautiful, powerful speech. All the other presidents, except for that Clinton's passage, just thank God Trump didn't come. That's all I can say. So,
isn't that the truth?
Yeah, that would have been a disaster. But
when Bush showed up for Coretta and they disinvited Harry Belafonte. You remember that?
Oh, wow. I forgot that.
See, this is what happens when you put the flag at the center rather than the struggle, the cross, the truth, the love,
the truth and the struggle. Yeah.
And no, that's got to be to the president. And let's be honest about it. The three presidents sitting there, all of them, you know, are different in different ways, but they tied to war crimes. All three of them.
Oh, of course. Well, I mean, is there a president in the... I mean, but that's the endless world that we're in.
Dropped on innocent people. 25,000 bombs dropped every year for most of those presidents in different places that the press doesn't talk about, you see?
Yeah.
That's what Martin was concerned about. That's what Fannie Lou
was concerned about.
Right, that's what Malcolm was beginning to get concerned about.
Yeah, Malcolm probably taught us more than anybody else in that regard, other than Du Bois, yeah. or C.L.R. James, or Victoria Garvin, or Mira Barak, yeah. somebody who was always concerned about what was going on outside. You know? Mm-hmm. Very much so.
But it is a kind of an end of an era in a way with John Lewis's passing. And I guess my big hope is that we can figure out how to have a truthful, unvarnished memory of those legacies that are also still filled with enough productive myth-making to inspire people to stay the course, right? Because sometimes we use truth-telling to diminish the force of the overarching arc of goodness that people have and people have been responsible for. And so I guess what I want to do is imagine that King and everybody else, right, who were imperfect people.
All human beings, right? Down.
But that the arc of the force of their efforts is what we want to recall while we still tell the truth about all of our human frailties. You know, John Lewis.
That's exactly. And what we want to avoid is what my dear brother Chris Hedges called boutique activism that accents just isolated issues rather than a deep activism that is critical of the system and how these issues are interrelated. Empire, capitalism, to race, gender, sexual orientation, and the binary, non-binary ways of being in the world and so forth, you see.
Yeah.
And that's what they lived for in the end, and that's what they died for in the end.
Yeah,
and,
that's true.
We don't want the legacy of our dear brother John Lewis to be solely that of the neoliberal valorizing of the flag, as opposed to that rich and deep freedom fighter that he was.
That transcends, as a right. man.
And there's continuity because he remained on fire in a lot of different ways.
That's
but it's
right.
more than just voting. Voting is one particular way of expressing your voice, but there's a whole host of other ways of being a freedom fighter, you see.
That's true. But if we could, I'll tell you, if we could get this voting thing to actually reflect the freedom fighter's spirit, that would be nice, which is why everybody don't want no mail-in voting. That's why everybody don't want no, you know, automatic registration. I mean, I can buy on the internet today anything I want using money I don't have, right? And they can figure out how to send it to me securely, but I can't vote without going to stand in a 5-hour line, 6 feet apart, in the middle of the sun on a non-holiday, but I get another holiday for shopping.
That's a key point. Isn't that the truth?
It's crazy. It's crazy. So, I mean, there's something to be said for fighting for that voting, not just to support the situation that we have, but to create a wedge. But first, we got to do what Yara has been doing, right? Which is read and read and read and think and read and think. So that when you're... when you're getting in that polling booth, or when they're, the options available to us for voting will be more meaningful and valuable.
Absolutely.
Well, we got to keep the struggle alive. Thank you so much for sharing so much today, Cornell. It's always a joy.
Thank you. It's just always a joy to be in dialogue with you.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us in Office Hours on The Tightrope.
Thank you for listening to the Tightrope Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast and share it with everyone you know. Please email all questions, suggestions, and compliments to 411@speakerbox.com. That's the numbers 411@speakerbox.com. The Tightrope Podcast is produced by Speakerbox Media in collaboration with the Podcast Laundry Production Company and is executive produced by Dr. Cornell West, Professor Tricia Rose, and Jeremy Berry.